the power. You got the mic.
No way.
Get ready for battle.
Give me your money.
Be the Black Knight.
All right. My name is Dan Thoreau, as always, and I am joined today by a very special guest who I hope recognized that music, given one of the games that he has designed very recently. I am joined today by Jeff Engelstein. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Yeah, that was exciting. For those of you that are listening, so before the show started, Dan said, oh, I normally don't play the theme music, but I picked out a song just for you. And I always get a little worried because whenever somebody says to me like, oh, we saw this piece of art or this furniture or this clothing that reminded me of you immediately, I always get very nervous because it never ends well. No, but that was good. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
So do you recognize that music?
I did not, but Black Knight, I'm assuming it's from the Black Knight pinball,
yes,
or something
Black
like that.
Black Knight 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Go. Well
context,
heard.
Please.
Yeah. Well, so Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. Now, by way of introduction, I imagine that you are possibly one of the hardest guests I have ever had to introduce because you wear so many hats. You're most recently known as a designer, of course, for things like The Expanse, Versailles 1919, and Super Skill Pinball, and you're maybe a little underknown for a little game called The Fog of War.
Yes, well, that's I'd love to talk about that. That's one of my favorite underperforming designs.
You're also known as a podcaster and math nerd. Of course, you're the co-founder of the ragingly popular Ludology podcast. You're an author. For example, right here on my desk, this is one of my cherished possessions. I have a deck of cards that was given to me by Tim Fowers. Which is basically the playing card version of your book that you co-wrote with Isaac Shalev, The Building Blocks of Tabletop Game Design. And you're also known as a parent of game designers Sydney and Brian Engelstein. So how do you do it all? Do you skip naps? What's your regimen?
Yeah, I don't know how this happened to me because I like grew up through my teen years and stuff as like really lazy and not doing a lot of projects and things like that. I am very scheduled. I have a full-time job, and then in the evenings, you know, I know like I have like an hour or two time set away, and I'm like, okay, tonight I'm going to work on this book, or I'm going to work on this game or whatever. And I just, you know, and you just chip away at it little by little by little, and eventually it gets done.
Very good. So we've listed a bunch of hats, of course. So designer and podcaster and math nerd. And what hats are we missing? Are you, for example, like a secret bonsaiist?
I am not. I do teach game design also at NYU. You didn't mention that.
Yes. Okay.
But in the non-game field, I enjoy films. My wife and I go to a lot of movies and watch a lot of films. We go like to the Toronto Film Festival and other film festivals that we enjoy. So I like that.
Oh, very cool. Have you ever been to Sundance?
I have not. That's on our list of what we want to do. It's a little bit trickier to kind of get there and to get accommodations and things like that. But it's something we definitely want to do.
I hear that Sundance attendees have kind of a bad rap among the film
crew.
Yeah.
The film circuit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. Toronto is the main one we go to, and it's just lovely. I love Toronto as a city, and you know, the way it's just spread out over the whole, you get to take advantage of the whole city. It's in theaters all over the place. So you get to travel around and go into different neighborhoods and stuff like that. So it's just a nice way to spend a long weekend.
So as a film guy, what is the best movie you've seen this year?
And this is one actually we saw at the Toronto Film Festival, though it was virtual this year. We watched it from our living room, although I had to pretend I was in Canada at the time. So don't tell the film festival. There may have been some IP spoofing involved. But we watched Seven Prisoners. Now on Netflix. It just went on Netflix like a week or two ago.
Okay.
And it is really intense, and it's a Brazilian film, and it's about a boy, late teens, early 20s, who goes with some friends to the rural towns to the big city to work. and what happens from there. So I won't say more than that, but it was really, and it did not go where I thought it was going to go, which is what's so interesting about it. I just, you know, love it when filmmakers will take things in a different direction.
Sure. So, you know, with so many skills, so many occupations, so many talents, I think that some of us who are down here on the mortal plane might think of you as hard to think of as a real person. So why don't you personify yourself a little bit, humanize yourself? What are you bad at apart from getting people to buy the fog of war?
Well, there's so many to choose from. I'm not really, I play, another of my hobbies is I play racquetball, and I do that extremely badly.
Well, next time you're in Salt Lake, let's play racquetball. I'm also bad at it.
Okay.
I am also a sub-amateur racquetballist.
Yeah. I broke my glasses. I hit myself in the face so hard with my racket that I hit my safety glasses, and then my regular glasses underneath got broken.
Oh, no.
I've also run into the wall a few times and injured my wrist. And it's just, yeah, I tend to be injury prone, but but I do enjoy it. So, yeah, that's one thing. I'll go with that.
Well, very cool. I hope we get to speak a little bit more and get to know you a bit better, maybe through some of your game designs today. Now, as I mentioned before we began, I'm in my lazy phase, so I have wanted to have a chat with you about like your last three games, and then I figure he's busy. So one of the games I wanted to ask you about, this is one of my favorite games from 2017. Can we talk about The Expanse?
Sure, I'd love to.
So what was that design process like? So I understand you were under some time pressure, which makes you a little bit like the real James Holden. now, I hope this doesn't come across as offensive, but I think of you as like the opposite of James Holden. So what was that design process like?
Impulsive and clueless. That kind of fits me, I guess. I don't know. But
yeah, impulsive and clueless. That's what I've said. Allies with whomever he has most recently spoken to.
Yes. It was really interesting. That was actually still, to a certain extent, is the only design that I've done that was kind of to spec. Every other design that I've done was just sort of an idea that I came up with, and I went through and worked it and played with it until, you know, I was happy with it, and then pitched it to publishers. You know, but that was the first one that I actually just got a call one day from Zev Schlesinger, who I'd known. He actually published my very first game, the Ares Project, way back in the dark ages. And he's now at WizKids. And he called me and said, "Hey, Jeff, we got two licenses. I was wondering if, you know, we'd love to have you design for either of them. One is for The Expanse, and the other was for the Blade Runner, new Blade Runner movie that was coming out. Blade Runner 20, whatever it was. I don't remember the year. 2049, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh my God, that's a difficult choice. can I call you back?" You know, and thought about it and decided that, you know, as much as I love both properties, The Expanse was the one that I wanted to. I was a huge fan of the books. Hadn't really seen, had seen a couple of episodes of the TV show, but had read all the books. And, you know, I could see an Expanse game in my head. But the Blade Runner game that I saw in my head was going to end up being like some kind of a Hidden Traitor game, probably social deduction kind of a game. And that's not really my strong suit, and not also what I really would love to design. Whereas the idea of, you know, The Expanse and the political intrigue and stuff like that really spoke to me much more as a designer. So, so I went back and I was like, yeah, I'd love to do Expanse. And this was in August of, well, I don't remember the year, but it was in August. And, if it came out in 2017, it was in 2016. August 2016, he comes to me and he says, "Great." He says, "But we need everything done, all the finished files by Thanksgiving."
Oh my goodness.
And I was like, 12 weeks. Okay. The Fog of War, which you have the aforementioned Fog of War, took me 14 years to design. And admittedly, that was a bit of an outlier. But yeah, most of my games are like 1 to 2 year design processes.
Sure.
You know, 12 weeks was just kind of crazy. And, but yeah, it's like, look, if you want to be a real game designer, I said to myself, you know, then you got to work under a deadline, you know, and if you kind of turn this down, maybe this chance won't come again, you know, with this opportunity, an opportunity like this to do a licensed game. So, So I said yes. And I was close. We actually got everything done the very beginning of January. So at the end of November, in November there was a playtesting convention here in New Jersey where we are called Metatopia. So we met there and we played it and we tweaked it a little bit through December. But it was basically done by the end of the year. So total design time was like 4 months, which is very, very rapid for me. I think for most game designers, I would think from a standing start.
Sure.
But I think that helped the design in a way. In the end, I think it was one of my better designs. And I think part of it was because of that. I had to focus on what I knew was going to work. I couldn't get distracted by the shiny objects off in the distance. So I started with kind of the initial concept I had was that this was like the Cold War in space. Because in the first book and the first season of the TV show, the first two seasons is covered, there's very little shooting. I mean, they're in these big warships and everything, but it's all posturing. It's all, threats. It's all diplomacy, So of course I'm like, okay, well, let's take a look at Twilight Struggle. Let's build on that. And also just in general, the coin games I wanted to, because I love the way the different factions had different objectives and things like that. And although some of that fell by the wayside, certainly the Twilight Struggle inspiration kind of stuck. And it was just, it was more, A, I have tremendous respect for that game. And also, just I needed something that I knew was going to work.
Yeah.
And I knew that system was going to work just because of the time scale that we had.
So instead of, were asymmetric victory conditions one of those shiny things that didn't end up making it into the game? So what would that have looked like?
The idea was that, everybody would have special abilities. So the four factions in the game, there's the UN, which is basically Earth, Mars, the OPA, which is like the asteroid belts and the kind of the people raised in space, the miners, and Protogen Corporation, who's trying to, I won't say it in case there's any spoilers out there, but they're an evil corporation doing evil things.
Yeah.
And, So Protogen was going to try to have, certain projects that they were going to have to complete. The UN was going to, basically trying to hold the bases that they had. Mars was, going to try to expand its power, and the OPA was going to try to get liberation, try to get freedom from the larger planetary bodies. The difficulty was that I couldn't really, it was hard to express just even from context of the book and even talking to the authors, like what like a Mars victory was going to look like in the context of the book, and the UN and how to really differentiate them and stuff like that. So I was just actually running into kind of thematic issues from the source material.
Yeah.
Which kind of, led me away from that. And I have a couple of interesting stories about that, which I don't know if we have time for, but hey, I'll throw them out there.
Well, yeah. So one of the questions I was going to ask, maybe this would fit with those stories. So you're one of those rare like engineering history crossovers. So you've studied both ancient history and engineering. You're a math guy. So what was it like adapting fictional history? Was it similar at all? You've made some historical games, or does it present its own challenges? I mean, I would think that one of the big differences is you could actually ask the source material questions directly if necessary.
Yeah, and I did have an opportunity to talk to one of the authors about. And they're both the co-authors, they're both gamers. I mean, The Expanse famously kind of started as a role-playing game, a role-playing campaign, I guess it was. They turned it into the books. But they had a really clear idea of what kind of they wanted. Like originally I was thinking about having gating events that you kind of work through sort of different chapters almost in the story that you work through.
Yeah.
But they very specifically wanted, they did not want that. They wanted a sandbox. They're like, let's set up the conditions at the beginning of the game, but then just let it go beyond that. But the other thing that I was considering as part of it was having planets, the planets moving around the sun to try to make it so as you moved around or as different forces moved around between the different planetary bodies, depending on the alignment of the planets, that it would take a shorter amount of time or a longer amount of time. I've always been intrigued by that idea for years for a game system and just thought maybe this was the opportunity to do it. And so I scoured the books trying to get a feel for how quickly these ships were moving. Like, how long did it take the ships to go from, you know, Earth to, you know, Jupiter or whatever.
Yeah.
And I could not, it was just maddening. It was nothing in the books about it. And I looked at them all. And so when I got to the, when I spoke to Ty, I was like, hey, what is sort of the speed? How can we, you know, cause I want to work it out. I want it to make sense. In the world of the book. And he said, we very deliberately made a choice when we wrote the first book that we were not going to say how long it takes for things to travel because we needed people to be where they needed to be and where they needed to get to and the time frame we needed to get to them on. And we didn't want to have to do with the nerd rage that the velocities weren't matching up and the acceleration vectors were this and that and the other thing. He said, so we have a special editing pass where we scrub out any mention of time frame or something where people can tell how long it takes to get from point A to point B.
Right.
So I thought that was really interesting.
I guess you could figure it out because you're a math guy. So what to generate sufficient thrust to travel at 1G from Earth to Jupiter during a home and transit window, what would it be? Just off the top of your head. You're a genius.
Well, they never actually say that they're at 1G. They don't actually say that anywhere in the book. So it's hard to judge from that. But then the other, you talk about history. I'm not answering that question. Actually, I should answer it because you would have no way to check me anyway.
Yeah, that's true. You could say whatever you'd like.
17.3 days.
That seems short. I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
But talking about history and that kind of thing, I mean, part of it is just sort of putting your interpretation on it and kind of tying it back to the source material. I mean, you kind of mentioned this in terms of Holman and his role in the book, and he's sort of the central character. And one of the things I decided early on is I didn't want the players to be the main characters in the book, right? But because I didn't want people to fight over who was going to get to be that character. And in any way, it was set up to be a strategic level view of the whole situation in the solar system. It wasn't supposed to be about one ship per se, even though the books are structured that way. So very early on, I wanted to include it. It needed to be included in some fashion in the game because that's just what the players would expect, just in terms of constraints and stuff like that. The idea I hit on pretty early was it would be this kind of it would be controlled by one player, and then it would jump around based on who was in last place. It would be sort of a little bit of a balancing act, and also, you know, just and I also felt in the book that the Rosinante just also, as you mentioned, that, you know, whichever way the wind blows, that they tend to go between different factions.
Right.
And in fact, I wanted them to start the game, although I did it originally, they were always going to start the game under control of the Protogen player, the Evil Corporation player. And Holman is he's like a goody two shoes. But my interpretation of the events was that he was being manipulated by them the whole time, even though, you know, he thought he was doing the right thing. He was actually just exacerbating the whole situation and making things worse.
Well, and that would seem appropriate to me. That's where it begins, is right. He's reporting the thing, right? The disaster.
Right. So when I spoke to the author, I was like, hey, you know, this is what I'm planning on doing, but I'm worried that I may get some pushback saying that, you know, he's a good guy. He wouldn't, why is he controlled? Why is he aligned with the bad faction at the beginning of the game or at any point during the game? You know, he would only. And so I explained my whole reasoning and he was like, oh yeah, you are absolutely correct. You know, he would, you know, that is fine. And so I go ahead, the game comes out, and of course, the first thread on Reddit about the game is, you know, Holman could be aligned with the bad faction. This game is completely broken. The designer has no idea what's going on, you know, doesn't know the source material at all. And so I don't know if you've seen the movie Annie Hall, going back.
Yes, I was just thinking of that scene. Isn't this how it should be?
Yes. Yes, in Annie Hall, when someone's arguing about it, and he turns around and the director is standing right behind him. He's like, well, I've brought the director with me to explain why you are wrong. And so that's what I did. I jumped into the Reddit thread, and I was like, well, actually, I spoke to the author before designing the game, and he said that I'm right. So there you go.
Would you call that the best vindication you've ever had in your design career?
It was certainly the most definitive.
Sure. So speaking of historical games, one of my absolute favorite examples from the last few years is Versailles 1919, which, of course, that was a collaboration with Mark Herman. What was it like working with one of Wargaming's scions? I hear he's a bit of a prima donna.
Is this when I say something, you bring Mark in from, well, Jeff, we just happen to have Mark waiting in the wings.
You know, I only bring that up because I've had the pleasure of playing with him a couple of times, and he's such a good guy. I know he wouldn't hold it against
me. No, he's a great guy, you know. And actually, the thing that was really interesting to me, I was a little bit nervous about kind of meeting him and getting with him. And it was kind of a crazy story the way it all happened. You know, I had him on Ludology, and you know, so I got to meet him that way. And then I don't remember which happened first, but I was, you know, basically there's a famous game store in New York City down in Midtown Manhattan called The Complete Strategist. And I was in there and I was buying a copy of Pericles, Mark's mm-hmm. game, Pericles.
Yeah.
And as I'm walking to the register, somebody just says to me, "Oh, great choice." And and he didn't know who I was, but I look up and it's, you know, it's Mark Herman.
Yeah.
You know, I recognize the voice. And so I introduced myself. I'm like, "Oh, you were on my podcast." And so we kind of became friendly then. But then, you know, we said, "Oh, we should do lunch or something." And it just, nothing ever came of that. But then a couple of years later, I had this idea of doing a Versailles game. And I did all this work and everything. And I started pitching to people at Gen Con. And I pitched it. I forget who I was pitching it to. I think maybe Uli Blenneman from Spielworks.
Oh, sure.
And I mentioned to, you know, told about the game. He's like, "It sounds fantastic, but I heard that Mark Herman is designing a Versailles game." So,
oh, how serendipitous.
I was like, "Oh, great." I said, you know, the world is waiting for two Versailles games that come out at the same time. And so I decided in an act of hubris, I suppose, to just reach out to Mark and say, "Hey, why don't we collaborate on something? You know, I'm working on it." And he was like, "Oh yeah, sure. That's good." It turned out he hadn't really done all that much. He had mentioned it in a design note for Pericles in the back, in the designer's notes. It says "next up Wilson" is what it said. It's all it said in there. It said "next up Wilson." Hmm. And everyone took that to assume that he was working on this game, but apparently he hadn't actually worked on it. So yeah, so we had that lunch and kind of went from there. And you know, he's a terrific guy. It's been a pleasure working with him. I've been really fascinated by how much he focuses on, and I feel stupid saying this, but you know, he actually, I think, emphasizes gameplay over historicity way more than I was anticipating.
Really?
You know? Yeah. He's like, "Yeah, you know, look, we'll figure out a way to explain this in the context of it, but we need it to work this way for the game to flow smoothly or to, you know." And so, you know, it was just interesting kind of working through that process with him and getting the benefit of his experience.
So if he hadn't worked on it at all, did the early game, was it principally your vision then with his assistance, or did you have to take two systems and work them into each other? What did that early process look like?
Well, he didn't really have much. I mean, the main thing he said to me, so I had worked on the main work I had done was I had put together, I said, "I want these issue cards." That was the first thing I did. I said, "I want the players to go through a deck of issues that they're resolving." And that's, you know, and so I had made up a list of 50, 60 issue cards. And that was, you know, they were nothing like the form they ended up in the game with, but just like a list of the topics and possible outcomes of all of them. And that was about as far as I'd gotten. And then I approached Mark and he was like, "Yeah." He says, "I haven't really done any work." He says, "But the main vision I have for the game is that there's going to be a deck of issue cards, but I haven't really put anything together yet." And I was like, "Well," I said, "you're in luck." And I took out my notebook and I was like, "Here you go. Here's a list of 50. I was like, "Oh, this is great. Let's rock and roll." And then we kind of went from there.
Well, very cool. So that game specifically, you know, I was going to ask you, one of the things that I really respect about Versailles 1919 is people tend to fall through the cracks in war games. You know, often you end up with this big strategic vision. They're great for teaching, you know, the geography and the maneuvers and some of the big issues. But one of the things that I love about Versailles 1919 is that you actually managed to have a bit of a human touch in there with the individuals who are passing in and out of the system. For example, you have a young Ho Chi Minh.
that's just a crazy story. You know, when I first read that, when I was doing research, that Ho Chi Minh, or that wasn't his name at the time, but that he was just living in Paris at the time and was a cook in the hotel where the negotiations were going on, and like found his way into the room and was able to like ask for help, you know, that Vietnam should be freed from the French. And he was just left out of the room and said, well, I guess we need to, you know, go do this ourselves. Right. And there's just so many stories like that, you know, the queen of Bulgaria or something, that she was just so disliked that like everything the Bulgarians asked for, they didn't get just because everybody hated her so much.
I know.
You know, it's just story after story. You know, Lawrence of Arabia was there and John Maynard Keynes was there, who kept saying, don't screw the Germans over because it's going to come back to haunt everybody.
Yeah.
And everyone just ignored him. You know, I mean, it's just so much. John Foster Dulles. It's just the names are just incredible.
Right. So when did you decide to put them into that game?
I don't remember the exact process of it, honestly. I mean, we just kind of had lists of people and we just felt that the people were really important to have some effects. You know, originally we were thinking about maybe having a deck of cards and you dealt them out to players, and that wasn't really working right. So, I mean, you know, those personalities and bringing in that flavor of being at that conference, of just feeling like you were at the center of the world, was really the experience that we wanted to bring to the players. So I think we always were going to have feature those people in one form or another.
So have you played Pericles now?
I have played like some of the introductory stuff, but I haven't really played the whole thing. So I should get Mark to play it with me. Teach me the game.
So you can confirm or deny if this is the case, but you know, Mark has a reputation for designing kind of these big, dense war games. And you have a bit of a reputation of, you know, focusing more on kind of this ease of process. And so when Versailles came out, I know that many people, myself among them, kind of viewed this as a powerful negotiated space, you know, that you have this big war game designer and we have you. So, you know, Pericles is one of these wonderful games. I absolutely love so much of what it's doing. And it is such a beast to play that I look at something like that and I wonder, could this have benefited from someone like Jeff Ingelstein coming in and helping us understand better what's going on or smoothing out rough edges? Was that something going on at all in Versailles, or was it just so much a collaborative process that you never had to come to loggerheads on that?
You know, Mark has got simplicity in him too. I mean, he did Fort Sumter, which is a pretty simple design. Some of his newer, like Napoleonics and his newer Civil War games, also have like 15 counters or something like that. So he certainly got that design streak in him. I think to a certain extent, it's a collaboration thing, and that's why I like collaborating with people. I actually came up with I can't talk about the topic yet, but I'm working on a new war game design right now, and you know, I'm like, I probably could have done it myself, you know, but I'm like, I do better when I'm with another person because they bring in my worst instincts sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing with Versailles. I mean, you know, there was a lot of times I wanted to add more complexity. Like I said, there was a lot of things, you know, historically that we kind of left on the cutting room floor that I wanted to bring in there, and Mark kind of hand waved away. And there was some stuff that he wanted to bring in that was, you know, I thought it was a bridge too far. So I think it definitely was not like I was, you know, on the simple side and he was on the complex side and we kind of drew together. We were both on both sides, but I think we were both good foils for our worst ideas. That there was just somebody there to say, you know, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So how's Triumvir coming along?
It's come along really well. We got a little bit delayed. Mark had his big Pacific War game. His reprint came out and he needed to take time to do a lot of proofing and reviewing and playtesting of that. And that's a beast. I mean, that's like thousands of counters and stuff like that, you know. So, and he's very exacting, detail-oriented on that kind of stuff. So, you know, he has taken up a lot of time. But I'm very excited about it. It's kind of started in the same place as Versailles, but it's gone in a very different direction because the factions are not – they're differentiated both more and less than Versailles in that, you know, each one kind of has special powers and things like that. But whereas the issues – in Versailles were very specifically like, this will harm the United States. You know, this will decrease happiness in the United States and things like that. This is not like this will hurt Caesar. It's more like you can pick who it will hurt, or it will hurt the person who's the least popular with the military and things like that. And also the victory is a lot more straightforward. You know, if there's not a lot of addition at the end of the game with points coming from different places.
Oh, cool.
It's all focused on, there's three strata, you know, there's the general public, the rich, and the military, and who's ever got the best relations with those three in various combinations, depending on whether there's two different types of endings. There's a Rubicon ending where you decide to try to take by force, and there's a political, you can try to get a political victory. Depending on the type of victory that the game comes down to at the end will determine how those, you know, how your relations will pay off at the end of the game.
Very cool. Now, lately, I've been smitten with a very different kind of game than Versailles. I'm speaking, of course, about Super Skill Pinball. This is one of the... I have been playing a lot of Super Skill Pinball solo, just to chase scores, but I also do play it with in groups. So if somebody's listening and they don't know what on earth we're talking about, what is Super Skill Pinball?
So Super Skill Pinball is it's a roll and write game, basically that simulates you playing pinball. You get two boards, one that represents that are dry erase. One is the table surface where all the bumpers and targets are and stuff like that. And the other is the back glass where you keep score, and sometimes other fun stuff happens on the back glass. And it's very, very, the core of it is really simple and straightforward. Somebody rolls two dice, and everybody gets to pick which of those two dice they want to use. People can use the same die if they want, or different dice. And you move your ball, you have a little ball token, and you move the ball to a target that matches one of the number that you picked. And then you cross off that number, and sometimes you'll score points, or sometimes you'll get a bonus or whatever. And that's basically the core. Then each turn, the ball has to move down the table. There's different zones on the table. You start at the top and you have to move down because, you know, gravity. And when you get to the bottom, hopefully you have an empty box that you can color in on a flipper. And then once it's on a flipper, you can shoot it back up to the top again and come down. So the core of it is really simple, but there's a lot of different strategies, and there's a lot of, you know, you can get different bonuses and timing and stuff like that. If you need to color in a box, if you can't color in a box for the die that you've chosen or for either of the dice, then you're going to lose the ball. But you can get multi-ball, you can get different bonuses, you can activate different modes. So it's got all the different features that you would love in a traditional pinball game.
Jeff, are you a former professional pinball wizard?
Well, when we talk about things I'm bad at pinball. We've always had, I grew up with a pinball machine. We had a Fireball pinball machine when I was a kid. And I've owned, since I had my own at home, we've owned like three different pinball machines now. We had a Hurricane, and then I got rid of that. I got a Star Trek The Next Generation, and then we sold that and we bought a Hobbit pinball machine. And I'm getting ready to sell the Hobbit and move on to something else. We usually keep a machine for like 3 or 4 years. But I'm not great at any of them, but I really enjoy playing it. So I've always loved pinball.
The only pinball anecdote that I have ever had is that my parents liked to take us on trips in a trailer, which was miserable. And I discourage anyone from thinking that that's a good idea for family cohesion. But one time we went to Sun Valley. Okay. And they thought that this would be a great trailer and biking trip. And I was just hating it because, you know, my family's fine. Don't tell my dad. In town in Sun Valley, there was like a little cafe, and they had a couple pinball machines. And that was the only way I could get out of hanging out with my family. Was I'd tell my dad, oh, I want to go play pinball. And because he had fond memories of pinball when he was young, he would let me go play pinball. And that's how I got away. And I was terrible at it. I lost a lot of money. Do you have any pinball anecdotes you could share with us that maybe would lend deep insight into your psyche?
I'm not sure about the deep insight into my psyche, but I do, you know, in my dorm in college in the basement, we had an 8-ball deluxe machine. I used to, play a lot. So we would, you know, really get into that. And, you know, that was a big thing that we would play, but I don't know if I've got any real, you know, deep, dark pinball secrets, I have to say.
So I think that maybe what it would be most telling is the insider pinballist's question. Do you prefer electrical mechanical pins or solid state?
I tend to prefer the solid states. I mean, just because I find that the gameplay is a little bit more interesting. But
so now
but,
you'll have to
certainly
explain
the
to
EM.
Me,
yeah.
What's the difference? I didn't come up with this question. My friend Chris, who knows pinball, he gave me this question. So I don't actually know. What's the difference?
Basically. The old EM machines, so those are the ones that don't have a little computer inside of them, right? So they're just, you know, it's the old ones in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. It's the one that just, you know, the targets pop down or whatever. There's some very rudimentary circuitry in there to control score and bonuses, but
sure,
in general, it's pretty basic. When you get into the 90s, that's when you started getting the ones that have like the what's called the DMD display, the dot matrix display in the back glass. It usually was like the orange or whatever, where sometimes they'd have mini games or different modes. And that's when the gameplay got a little more advanced. So Apple Deluxe actually, I think, was electromechanical. Maybe it was right on the cusp of that because it had some voice synthesis in it and stuff like that. But then, you know, when you get into like the Star Trek Next Generation, I don't know if you play that or Adam's Family or like that classic age, that's when they were solid state machines.
Okay. So if you were not a former professional pinball wizard, where did Super Skill Pinball come from? What made you sit down and say, I'm going to make a pinball roll and write game?
It was actually while I was playing a game of pinball in my basement. I was just playing, and as the ball was kind of rolling down, I'm a huge fan of a game from the 90s, maybe early 90s, called Take It Easy. I don't know if you're familiar with this game.
I'm not.
So Take It Easy is one of the earlier examples of what I call a bingo game. You have like a hexagonal grid on your board, and everyone's got the exact same set of tiles. And one person's the caller. One person randomly picks one of their tiles and says, tile number 12. And everybody pulls out tile number 12 and puts it on their board in any space that they want. And then you go another tile. And each subsequent tile has to be placed adjacent to a tile you've already placed.
Okay.
And each tile, the hex tiles have three lines on them going in the three different directions of three different colors. And basically you're trying to form stripes that are as long as they can possibly be. That's the whole game.
Okay.
And at the end, when all the tiles are placed, you know, then you count your score and who's ever did the best. But I like it because, you know, there's a huge amount of luck associated with it. Because, you know, it's just a random sequence of tiles, right? You don't know which one's coming up. Not all the tiles get drawn. So you may be hoping for a specific tile that's going to fit perfectly in this spot that you've left open, but it may never get drawn. But at the same time, it doesn't feel random. It doesn't feel unfair from a luck standpoint because everybody's using the same sequence of tiles, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your sister gets more score, you know, higher score than you do, well, you know, she had the same sequence and you did. Maybe she just made better choices or just, you know, whatever, maybe got a little lucky here and there, but it just doesn't feel the same, right, as that way. And so I just married those two ideas of like sharing, you know, everybody completely sharing the same dice. And, you know, can kind of set it up however they want to set it up. I mean, a lot of other roll and writes at the time when I was doing it were more about, you know, you would draft dice and the other players would use different dice. So even though, you know, there was some sharing, but it was never all exactly the same of what everybody did. And I'm sure at somewhere down the line, it was a Yahtzee variant that maybe did that where everybody shared the same dice. But I thought it was a little bit unique and I just love the idea of pinball. I felt that it was be super duper thematic and, you know, that there would be a lot of stuff that come into it. But that was the genesis of the idea, was just playing pinball and thinking about that game, Take It Easy.
So many, many people have remarked, and me among them, maybe because I'm not very good at pinball, but they've remarked that the system you have designed really does feel like pinball. Was that something you were always trying to go kind of this verisimilitude, you know, you feel like this thing is moving fast, you're losing control of it, or was that just a happy byproduct?
No, I was absolutely what I was going for from the get-go. So I really wanted all of the, you know, I wanted to make it feel like pinball. In fact, you know, even though it was kind of working as a game, it didn't really feel like pinball. And I had a breakthrough in the design process, which in retrospect sounds completely ridiculous that I didn't, that it, it literally took me a year. I started working on the game and then, you know, I spent like a year on it and I wasn't really getting anywhere. The whole thing was based around pads. And you would like color in circles on the pad because all roll and writes at that point were based on pads of paper. That's what it was. And so that's, so I did the pad of paper. It's roll and write. It's got to have a pad of paper. So I did a pad of paper. And the way I even did like the different, but I didn't want people to have to erase stuff. So once you colored in a circle, it always stayed colored in. So the way I did for different balls, so I had three different balls, is I had some, there were next to each target, there were circles that you could color in or squares or hexagons. And each ball had a different shape. So when you were on the square ball, you can only color in the square boxes, circle ball, circle boxes. And it worked, but it was just like, it didn't really, you couldn't reset the targets. You know, each target had like one set of each, you know, so when you finished the target, you got a bonus, but that was it. The targets were down for the rest of the ball and stuff like that. And it also was incredibly hard to just visually understand what was going on when you looked at your sheet because there was so many circles.
It sounds cluttered.
Yeah. I should probably post pictures of it. It just looked ridiculous. And then I don't, you know, like I said, a year I was looking on this for tons of people play this. They liked it, but they're like, it's not quite right. It just doesn't feel quite right. And then I was like, wait a second. What if it was on a dry erase board and you could like erase the targets when you were finishing them? And so I reached out to a few publishers. I hadn't shown it to anybody. It was just, you know, I'm friends with some publishers. I'm like, would you consider doing a roll and write game with markers and, you know, dry erase boards? I'm like, oh yeah, no problem. That would be fine. And it was like, you know, from then from that point to finishing the design was like, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something.
Just
everything fell into place. Like the resetting of the targets. So then you could erase, which is such a big thing. It's like when you do a whole set of targets that you get to erase them and you can fill them in again, is such a huge part of the feel of the game. So that totally just came from switching to dry erase boards. And also just in general, you know, the original sin of board games is rules and having to teach them to people.
Right.
That's the biggest barrier as a designer that you have to get over. So any rule, A, that you can just eliminate is always the best. But B, if you can't eliminate it, if you can tie it into a framework that the players already have in their head, you're going to be way better off. So like I just did it a couple of minutes ago. I talked about, you know, like the ball moves down because of gravity. I always put that word gravity into my description because it's like, oh yeah, of course it moves down. People will never, ever forget that rule.
Right.
Because gravity, you know, same thing like with, you know, in Space Cadets Dice Duel, the moment that, you know, when you use dice to assemble stuff. And I say like, okay, when you're making a torpedo, you got to give it a nose and a middle and a tail and this little thing. And then it's a torpedo and then you've loaded a torpedo tube and people just understand that instantly. And so wherever possible, we tried to do that in this game, you know, bumpers, we wanted to act like bumpers and even like the nudging and tilting, which is probably my favorite rule in the game, you know, again, just ties thematically into what people are expecting. You know, you can bump the table. Of course you can bump the table. It's pinball. When you bump the table, you can get it to go where you want. But if you get it to go where you want, there's a chance you may tilt. And the harder you bump it, the more chance there is that you're going to tilt. And so it just fits. So it serves double duty because not only does it make it easier to remember the rule, and even like with nudging and tilting, if you don't remember the exact specifics, you at least know it's there and conceptually it's in your brain. But it also enhances the experience of the game, which is ultimately what I'm always going for is that it, you know, it builds on that. So the metaphor does double duty of making your game easier to learn and also more enjoyable.
You know, one of the things that I do love about it is just how easy it is to teach this game. You know, I've taught this maybe to 8 or 9 people now, and it's just this sequence of, oh, that's obvious. Moments, you know, so I say, well, here it goes in here. And if it hits this, it's going to kind of bounce around in there. And if it hits this, it's going to flip it down and you get bonuses and it has to move down. They go, oh yeah, that's obvious. And then, you know, you flip it up and yeah, that's obvious. It goes to one side or the other. And I say, and then you can tilt it. And usually that's the moment where they go, oh yeah, yeah, of course you can tilt it. That's obvious. But it's that little touch that you maybe didn't think would be in the game that was put in there. Was tilting always part of the game that you could...
Actually, tilting came from Zev.
Really?
Yeah. He said it would be great. I originally didn't have tilting, and he was like, it'd be great if there was some way we could do tilting. And we actually went back and forth. We brainstormed. I think ultimately I kind of, polished the idea, but, we talked about that, and it was a lot of design. There was a lot of different options that we tried and different things and what would be easy or harder, whatever. And I'm happy, very happy with where it ended up with. So, because it just thematically, it was one of the last things that was added to the game. Just thematically,
it's pretty much perfect the way that it works now, because if you just make a small modification, you're almost certain to not get in trouble.
Yeah, although when I played it on stream with Shut Up and Sit Down, he tilted all three rounds. Every three rounds, he tilted. I was very impressed. Really? I'd never seen that happen before. Yeah, it was like a running gag. By the time we got to the third round, I was like, we know you're going to tilt. Just here it goes. But yeah, so in terms of teaching it also, I like because you can start playing right away and you can teach as you go. It's one of those games where, And that's always when I demo stuff at cons and things, I always try to structure it in a way where possible that you can get people playing within seconds.
Well, it's super easy to teach. And this goes along with what Roland Wrights are doing that's kind of interesting to me right now, especially the ones that start with that identical input, but let players branch out in different directions, is your first few turns are pretty much going to be the same. Even if you hit different targets, those first three or four rounds until you hit your first flipper, they're often it's just a difference, slight difference in target,
right.
I'm going to hit this, drop target, and you can hit that one if you, want a different bonus. But until we hit the flipper and go different directions,
yes,
it's so similar that it's very easy to teach on the fly.
Yeah. Cause you can watch what people are doing and whatever. Yeah. And it's, I've never seen people always like, well, can't two people just play the exact same game the whole time? I'm like, well, yeah, but I've never, ever, ever seen it ever. At some point, like I think in your review, you mentioned it's like the quantum many doors, multiverse.
Right.
It's kind of what it is, right? At some point, somebody's going to make a small change from what you did. And it's just, it's like chaos theory in action. It's a small difference in everything. Changes. But actually, interestingly, we did have a little bit of an issue with the Pin Pal one. So in the new one, we have actually one where you play with a partner.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you noticed this. I don't know if anybody's going to specifically notice, but the tables for the pair, it specifically says you use this table and your partner uses this table because the numbers are different on the two different tables. The table layouts are the same. But like, if you look at the bumpers, like the numbers in the bumpers are different. So you can't physically go exactly the same way that your partner is going. Cause that kind of breaks the game. If you both go exactly, just always choose the same number. It was a little bit of a broken strategy. So we had to deal with that by switching the numbers around in the table. So they were slightly different. So they're like bingo pads, where they look the same, but the numbers are all scrambled up.
Yeah. That makes sense. So, the second set, so you've released two sets of Super Skill Pinball so far. The first one is 4K'd. Second one is Ramp It Up, which I very recently reviewed. And Ramp It Up, so I was starting to get a little bored with 4K'd, and there, along comes Ramp It Up. WizKids, was it WizKids? Yeah, it's WizKids, right?
Yes.
They asked if I wanted a copy, and I said, well, I've played a lot of Super Skill Pinball. I don't know if I want more. And then they sent it to me, and my goodness, I love it. It really is moving to the next level. Did you feel like you had to top yourself, or are you running out of ideas? Where's your headspace at with this system?
I did not feel I had to top myself, but I feel like I learned a lot from those first four tables. Getting to play with the system and watch other people play it and, me play them a lot more. I was like, oh, I can do this and I can do this and I can do this. And, I've learned more and more about what makes tables better. So I just think in general, those tables, have some more interesting features. And I got rid of some of the other features, which were a little more problematic in the base set, like spinners. There's no spinners in Ramp It Up. Spinners generated more rules questions than every other thing combined.
Okay.
But it's just been fascinating to me about how it's like a scaffold on which you can build so many other things. I mean, we've got, you know, there will be some more super skill pinball tables coming out. So we've got some sets that hopefully we'll be able to announce soon. But I will, by the time, I'm not sure when this is going to air, but most likely by the time this is out, we'll have another free print and play. So with each set, okay. they've posted.
This will air in January.
Plays. Okay. Well, that will definitely be out. So there's going to be print and plays, for both basic sets, they took copies of the tables, that are included that you can buy, but just have them as a free print and play. But also for the holidays, we're releasing a special Christmas themed table.
Oh, very cool.
Totally for free. It's not going to ever be in any sets as far as I know. So just a little fun little holiday thing. And that's got, again, you know, it's fun because you start with a theme and then you kind of can backfill the system into the theme. So I've got, this Christmas tree bumpers, and we've got reindeer games that you can get into. And So I adapted actually the game Shut the Box, the old classic game Shut the Box, is kind of built into the game. I've got other ideas to do, like tic-tac-toe and build, you know, and all, like a connection game, like, you know, Ticket to Ride, kind of expressed as a pinball machine. There's all kinds of crazy ideas in different directions as you can take it. So I feel like Ramp It Up just was kind of scratching the surface of some of the craziness that we can do. So,
well, and that's one of the things I love about that set, is that to me, it was sort of a revelation, just how much more you can play with this system. Cause you know, when I played 4K'd, it was great. I really enjoyed it. But by the time I had finished with the fourth table, I was going, oh, that's great. Now I've seen this system. And there are plenty of roll and write games where sometimes I think of them as they're good for groups. I love the way that they play with probabilities and numbers, but they're kind of a mile wide, an inch deep sometimes. And then I played Ramp It Up, and I was going, wow, you know, he's playing with speed. You know, top speed, that's the first time I really feel like I'm losing a ball because it's going too fast. Or the heist table. You know, you're doing so many exciting things that I was going, no, I can see ways that you can now tinker with this system in really interesting ways.
Yeah. And part of it is I got to keep myself interested when I'm designing them, right? Because <Yeah. laughs> I'm playing these tables over and over again. And that's one thing that actually, just as a designer, just a little inside baseball. I mean, one of the biggest pain in the ass things is, you know, play testing and getting groups together and doing it. And, you know, there's ways, you know, you can do it online, but that has its own deficiencies and stuff like that. The beauty is when I'm designing these tables, because everything plays so great solo, is, I can completely test it. I design in Adobe Illustrator. I just test them in Illustrator. I just lock the layer, and I just have a layer of like black squares and balls, and I just can play it right on the screen myself and test it. So, you know, so I can play through these, rapidly iterate on these tables and play them. So that's, you know, that makes it a lot of fun, and just, you know, simplifies the whole process. And I think ultimately leads to better games, because, you know, the more I can play them and tweak them and stay mentally interested, the better off it's going to be.
So what's the future like for Super Skill Pinball? So you mentioned the free Christmas table. Mm-hmm. You have probably at least one set coming.
Yeah, well, we're in just some discussions. And this is another thing, just when you talk about metaphor, right, is when you think pinball, you know, everybody thinks themes and everyone thinks like licensed type tables, right?
Yeah.
So we're in some discussions with some IP based tables. So, you know, hopefully we'll be able to make some announcements around that. So that hopefully will be very exciting. And you know, we'll see where it goes. You know, it's I think there's a lot of I would love to, you know, just sort of see an annual pack. It's a relatively inexpensive game, right? It's like you know, $20, $25, and get four tables for four people. So it's a nice pack. And I think it's, you know, value-wise, it might be the kind of thing that people could pick up, you know, each year there would be a new pack that comes out and people say, oh, you know, what's that crazy Jeff doing this time? You know, what are some of the different things? And, you know, and I'd love to see like a fan community. There's been some discussion about people, you know, wanting to make tables, and I totally encourage that. If you want to make a super skill pinball table and post it, I will, you know, be happy to promote it and, you know, give you some publicity for it.
Yeah, it does seem diverse in that it's the kind of game where if you wanted to play with a big group, it's not very cost prohibitive to get two. I even, when I mentioned that I had reviewed it, one commentator, he had bought the first game and split it with his friend because it was so easy to divvy up.
Because yeah, right. Because everything comes in multiple. Yeah, there's four copies of each table. So each person takes two sets. And yeah, if you're mainly going to play it solo, get it with four of your friends. It's $5 each. Boom. You know, you got four completely different tables that you can play. That's a pretty good deal.
So, Jeff,
okay, Steve, I'm going to tell you one little quick little secret, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
It's just been weird to me. We talk about metaphor and stuff like that, and the way that works thematically is that in the solo game of Super Skill Pinball, I never ever say anywhere in the rules anywhere about how you win the game. There is no win condition.
Yeah. Right.
And nobody has ever said anything about it in all of the reviews or anything, all the comments. Nobody has said, how do you win the solo game? Right. It's just because, again, the metaphor, it's pinball, right? Nobody walks up to a pinball machine expecting to win or lose the game, right? You're going against the high score of the target or whatever. I mean, some people have said like, hey, what's a reasonable target for this table or whatever, but
yeah,
I just find it fascinating. That's like, you know, I just completely ignored that. I mean, it would have been easy to, you know, we put a ridiculously low score on the back of the, you know, we have a little high score table, right, where you can track it. We do have a starter score, which is super low. So I guess in that sense, you know, you have something to shoot for, but there's no real any like, you know, this is a good score. This is a great score. This is an excellent score. You know, this is a pinball wizard score, right? It's nothing. It's just, we say nothing about how to win the game. At first,
you know, I actually noticed that. I went through looking, just because anytime I play a solo game, I do want to know if there's a score target that I should be going for. And it didn't matter to me just because, you know, we had been recording our scores and I already had some targets that we had set ourselves. But yeah, that's a great point. The way that metaphor extends to the way we think about our expectations of play. So is there anything else you'd like to, so you've got some projects coming up, anything else you'd like to leave us with?
No, really the best way to keep track of what I'm doing, is you can follow me on Twitter, is at G Engelstein, GENGELSTEIN. There's a link also in my bio there to my Game Tech newsletter, which is a new thing that I've started like over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah.
I've really been enjoying doing that. It lets me expand on some of the other topics. It's kind of acts like sort of a free form blog and thoughts and things. And I can really dive in depth on some of the game design topics that I enjoy.
Well, very cool. Thank you so much, Jeff. It was wonderful getting to chat with you.
Thanks for having me.
Give me your money.
Beat the Black Knight.